Well, this week we come to consider the final parish, of the Bereishis, Parshas Vayechi. But before we embark on our discussions of the Parsha, I would like to take a few moments to address a matter of Inyan HaDiyoma, and that is the day that we have entered already here. And that is the day of Asara B'Tevis, the 10th of Tevis, which, as we know, is one of the four fasts that we have in the year that are related to the Churban, to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And in fact, of the four, the 10th of Tevis marks the earliest stage in that regard. That is to say, it is the day where Nebuchadnezzar laid siege against the city of Yerushalayim, which then became Shivasa Ratamas when the walls were breached, and Tisha B'Av when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And then there was even a follow-up tragedy where the last ember of autonomy was wiped out with the death of Gedaliah. That is Tzom Gedaliah. I think it's fair to say, experientially, that it's easier to relate to the 17th of Tammuz and the 9th of Av because they bracket the season, what we would call, of Avelus, of mourning over the Beis HaMikdash. The other two catch us off-season, in the middle of nowhere, or maybe in the middle of other things. And then we're brought back into this arena with the 10th of Teves, and certainly Tzom Gedaliah, which is in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But to the matter at hand of Asara B'Teves, to try and get some deeper insight into the uniqueness of this fast, and perhaps even ultimately why it comes at the time of the year when it does. But let us preface by referencing a most astonishing comment by one of the late Rishonim, the Abu Dharam, Rabbi David Abu Dharam, a student of the Tur, who's the well-known as the author of his Sefer on the Tfilos, Sefer Abu Dharam, makes the following statement. We know that the calendar for us is fixed. We know in advance which days of the week certain calendar dates can fall, which case they can't fall. Generally, a calendar date can fall on 4 days of the week and not on the three that it won't fall, Lo Adu Rosh, etc. Which means that for us, the 10th of Teves can never fall on Shabbos. It can fall on Friday. It's the only fast that we have that actually would that could fall on Friday. And as we know, we bring the fast into Shabbos. It's broken at Kiddush time. But it can never fall on Shabbos in terms of the calendar as we have it fixed. But in a time where the calendar would be determined on a much more ongoing basis, and any calendar date could fall on any day of the week, what would happen if the 10th of Tevis fell on Shabbos? And the Abu Dharam says, we would fast. The 10th of Tevis would override Shabbos. And he adduces support for this idea. Of course, that itself is a chiddush, what he's about to say. But it's from the pasuk in Sefer Yechezkel. Sefer Yechezkel is not a sefer that we traverse so regularly, but part of it is about them hearing about the Churban. And in Perek Kaf Dalet Pasuk Hey, it says, Ben Adam, as many psukim in Yechezkel begin, Ben Adam, Hashem says to Yechezkel, Ksav lecha eshem hayo, write for yourself the name of the day. Es etzem hayom hazeh, this very day. Somach melech Bavel el Yerushalayim, the king of Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, laid siege on Yerushalayim. Be'etzem hayom hazeh. There is a phrase that is repeated in this pasuk, the phrase be'etzem hayom hazeh, and we have associations with that phrase. It is used in the Torah with reference to Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur, we know, when it falls on Shabbos, obviously overrides Shabbos. And the Abu Dharam claims, and maintains that likewise Asara B'Teves, were it to fall on Shabbos, we would fast on Shabbos if it's Asara B'Teves. Now, it has been pointed out that this is not a unanimously agreed upon position. Rashi and Maseches Megillah and the Rambam and Hilchos Tanis both seem to indicate that, like all of the other fasts, if Asara B'Teves fell on Shabbos, it would be pushed off to the Sunday. But the Abu Dharam is of the opinion it would take place on Shabbos itself. And the question, of course, is why? As if to say, generally speaking, Avelus, and certainly of a public nature, will not override Shabbos. Even Tisha B'Av, and for us, Tisha B'Av can fall on Shabbos, and we know what happens when it does. The fast is pushed off to Sunday. And that's Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is as bad as it gets. There is something about a siege. There is something terrible about a siege in the sense that it's the beginning of the end. There is a military adage with regards to sieges, place assiégée, place prisée. A place besieged is a place captured. It's barring a miracle, nothing's happened and it's all over. That is true. But at the same time, is the beginning of the end worse than the end of the end? Meaning, with all of the terrible connotations of a siege, it's worse than the destruction itself? So it's hard to understand what is the background, what is the understanding of the Abu Dharam's comment. But the matter is explained by the Chasam Sofer. And the Chasam Sofer's explanation is based on a comment of the great Rabbi Shimshon of Astropoli in his Perush Dan Yadin on the Sefer Kabbalistic work called Sefer Karnaim. And the first thing the Chasam Sofer alerts us to is that we may be of the understanding or might have thought that the four stages that we spoke about, the siege, the breach, the destruction, and so on, they all happened more or less at different months within that same year. That's not correct. The siege that began on the 10th of Teves was 2.5 years before the breach of the walls. Jerusalem withstood the siege of Nebuchadnezzar for 2.5 years, which means it was Asara B'Teves, and then a year went by, and another year went by. And then a few months later, in the third year of the siege, on the 17th of Tammuz, the walls were breached. Some of the dates of the fasts take their cue from the first Churban, some the second Churban. We're not going to get into that right now, but it was 2.5 years. And what are the implications of that idea? Says the Chasam Sofer, the 10th of Teves was when the whole process began. And when the process began, I'd hesitate to call it the Rosh Hashanah of the destruction, but this was a time when the matter was decided in Beis Din Shalmala, in the Heavenly Tribunal, what would be this year? The siege has begun, what will be its outcome? And in that first year, says Chasam Sofer, Beis Din Shalmala determined that the Beis HaMikdash will not be destroyed this year. And in the second year, a year later, likewise, not to be destroyed this year. But in the third year, it was yes decreed that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed that year. And it was the 17th of Tammuz of that year, the walls were breached, and the 9th of Av on that year, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And the implications for the 10th of Teves now is, says the Chasam Sofer, this convening of Beis Din Shalmala continues every year, even after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. With what in mind? If this was when the Heavenly Tribunal originally convened to determine whether this would be the year that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed, it convenes again every year to determine whether it should remain destroyed, remain in a state of destruction, or could this be the year that things will be reversed, and the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, and the Geula will come. That means the fast, the day of the 10th of Teves, has a unique quality to it. It doesn't just, quote unquote, face backwards, lamenting and mourning destruction that happened. It faces forwards to see if a different outcome can be procured for this year. And this brings us to the fast of Asarah B'Teves. As a rule, we know we don't fast on Shabbos because Shabbos is not a time for Avelus and Shabbos is a time of Oneg. But there is one exception, and that's mentioned in the Gemara. There is one type of fast which the Gemara in the fifth parak of Maseches Brachos says one would undertake even on Shabbos. And that's what's called a Tanis Chalom, a fast that is in order to bring about a good outcome to a dream. If a person has a dream and he's terribly troubled by it, and he sees it as a portent of terrible things that might happen, and the understanding is that if he will fast, that could reverse that decree, he may do so on Shabbos. If he had this dream on Friday night, he can fast the next day, and it overrides everything else. And in fact, not only does it override what we call Oneg Shabbos, the Shulchan Aruch says something quite surprising. That's his Oneg Shabbos. If you say to him, you have the opportunity to reverse this decree, do you want to take it? And if you do, then the way to do that is through fasting. Nothing will make him happier. That's his Oneg Shabbos. If you force him to eat, he'll be miserable, because he forewent that opportunity of getting rid of this evil decree in a dream. That's Tanis Chalom. Sometimes, what do we see from here, says Chassam Sofer? You fast on Shabbos, and if it can change an outcome for the future. And have we not discovered that is exactly what Asarah B'Teves is about? If Asarah B'Teves would fall on Shabbos, we'd fast because it's like a Tanis Chalom. It's not, again, just looking back at the future and looking back at the past and mourning the past. It's with an eye to the future. If used correctly, if harnessed rightly, the fast of Asarah B'Teves can change, can turn around the course of the future of the history of the Jewish people. That's worth it. And that's Oneg Shabbos, just like a Tanis Chalom. So this is, I believe, a truly fascinating understanding of what makes Asarah B'Teves unique. We say that a siege, in its own way, is the beginning of the end. But the Chassam Sofer is alerting us to the fact that if it's used correctly, Asarah B'Teves can be the beginning of a new beginning. And even as in our calendar, it will not fall on Shabbos, this idea remains true whatever day of the week it is, whether it's Tuesday, as it will be tomorrow, or any other weekday. Certainly something well worth bearing in mind. And I believe that perhaps now the 10th of Teves is not as off-season as we may have thought. The 10th of Teves comes a week after Chanukah. And what is Chanukah if not inaugurating the dedication, firstly, of the second Beis HaMikdash, but with a view to inaugurating the third Beis HaMikdash? We're in the middle of that process. That's what we say every day of Chanukah when we light the menorah. Az egmor b'shir mizmor. In the future, we'll finish Chanukah HaMizbeach, which means it's a process that has begun, it hasn't finished. We're looking to move ourselves decisively further along that path. And along comes Asarah B'Teves just a few days later, exactly with that in mind. So this might not have been part of the season we would have expected it to, but maybe it's exactly part of the season that it needs to be. And I believe it's a completely new perspective now on this fast of Asarah B'Teves. And we hope that this is the year that the turnaround will happen. Certainly, the better informed we are, the better armed we will be for that. Well, to come now to Parshas Vayechi, the beginning of the Parsha, as we know, has Yaakov calling Yosef and requesting of him, but more than requesting of him, really, that he should not be buried in Mitzrayim, he should be taken to Eretz Canaan. Rashi gives the famous three reasons as to why that should be. He doesn't want there to be kinim around him and all the other perushim of Rashi. Rav Hirsch adds to this, where the patriarch is buried represents in its own way a connection or a setting down of roots in that place. This is now something that ties us to this land. And Yaakov says, I do not want to be the reason that the Jewish people are tied to the land of Mitzrayim. We're here because we need to be here. As soon as the time comes to leave, we'll leave. No one should look back because Yaakov was there. But there is no essential connection between Yaakov and Mitzrayim and any place other than Eretz Canaan. Very thought-provoking comment of Rav Hirsch. But in the as the psukim continue, the beginning of the parsha, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Yosef has said he'll do it. Please don't bury me in Mitzrayim. Take me back to Maris Machpelah, to Eretz Canaan. Yosef says he'll do it. And then in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Vayomer Hishav Oli, I want you to take a shvua. Swear to me that you'll do it. Vayishav Alo, and he does. And that's very interesting. Why does Yaakov require Yosef to take a shavua, and why is it his word not enough? But as we know, Yosef's word is not enough here because the decision is not entirely in Yosef's hands. After all, he needs to request permission from Paro to be able to take Yaakov back. And in fact, that is exactly what the Pasuk tells us after Yaakov passes away. This is in Perek Nun. The beginning of Perek Nun, Yosef approaches Paro, and he says, Avihish bi'ani lemor. My father made me swear to him that I would take him back. And Paro's response in Pasuk Vav of Perek Nun, Vayomer Paro, Ale, go, ukuvor, go up, ukuvor savicha, kasher hishbiecha. And bury your father there as he made you swear to him. We see that the oath is of the essence here. Yaakov requires it. Yosef mentions it. Paro concedes to it. What is the background to this? Well, the Gemara gives us the background in the following way. It relates to the parsha of a couple of weeks ago when Yosef is released and he interprets Paro's dreams. So the Gemara in Maseches Sota in Daf Lamed Vav Amud Beis famously recounts how Yosef is able to understand all the languages that Paro is speaking. Paro had his famous 70 steps leading up, however many languages you know, that's how close you can get. Yosef doesn't know any of these languages, but the Malach Gavriel comes on the night before he leaves and gives him a crash course in every one of the 70 languages. He just needs to say the name of the language, and he knows it. That is what we refer to in the Shir Shalyom for Thursday when we talk about Eidus B'Yosef, B'Tseisol Eretz Mitzrayim. It's about Yosef emerging on the Egyptian scene. Sfas lo yadati eshma. Languages that I never knew, I can now hear and understand. And Yosef is conversing with Paro in 70 languages and he reaches the top, 70 for 70. And then Yosef starts speaking to Paro in Lashon HaKodesh, and Paro doesn't know Lashon HaKodesh. So this is a very awkward moment for Paro. He is the master of all the languages, and yet here's one he doesn't know. He tried to learn it from Yosef, says the Gemara, but he didn't succeed, which is itself is very significant as to understanding what Lashon HaKodesh is. And therefore, he can't learn it. Yosef has a knowledge that he doesn't have, and Paro, in the circumstances, did the honorable thing, and that is he made Yosef swear that he would never tell anyone that there's this language that he knows that Paro doesn't know. So Yosef swore, but that would come back to haunt Paro. And the way the Gemara describes it is that Yaakov knows the only way that Yosef will be able to take him out of Mitzrayim is if he takes a Shavua. Why? Because the Gemara describes he came to Paro and said, my father made me take a Shavua. Paro doesn't want to let Yaakov go. Yaakov is the best thing that ever happened to Egypt. He just had to enter the country. The famine stopped. They're not going to let him go so easily. But Yosef says, but he made me swear to him that I would take him out, says the Gemara. So Paro says to Yosef, well, go and get it annulled. Get an annulment. We'll solve everything. And Yosef says, I'm not sure that you want me to do that. Because if I'm already getting that oath annulled, Maybe there are other oaths that I can get annulled. For example, the one that I swore to you that I wouldn't tell anyone that you don't speak Lashon HaKodesh. If I can take my oaths so lightly, so then perhaps they can both go. At that point, Paro conceded. He had no choice. And that's why he says, go and bury your father, Kasher Hishbi'echa, and Yosef was released to bury Yaakov in Eretz Canaan. This is a well-known exchange. Rashi brings it, or a version of it, in Perek Nun, Pasuk Vav, there. And we've spoken about this from other angles in the past, the notion that Paro currently Lashon HaKodesh, it seems ever, permanently. In other words, that's a long time since he first met Yosef, and he still can't speak Lashon HaKodesh, apparently. I mean, why not have a chavrusa with Yosef, you know, a couple of times a week? Paro, in any case, seems to be semi-retired. Yosef is running the country. Someone else can, it should have time on his hands. There's something about, says the Chasam Sofer, there's something about Lashon HaKodesh in its pure sense that Paro can never learn. Either way, be that as it may, that was the situation, and Yaakov anticipates this from the outset. And that's why he adjures Yosef and makes him take a shvuah. Now, there is a principle with regards to a certain area of Torah. We know that the words of Chazal can be divided into two domains, halacha and agada. Halacha is Jewish law, and agada is best defined as everything from Chazal, which is not halacha. That's the definition given by Reb Shmuel Hanagid in his famous introduction to the Talmud. And it includes the stories that Chazal will relate, and the other statements and ethical exhortations, and everything that's not halacha. Everything that's about halacha, but is not actual halacha, everything which is about everything. So these are the two domains, halacha and agada. Very often, there may be an agada which, if you contemplate it, might have halachic ramifications, the way that agada is expressing itself, or something that it mentions within the course of the description. Can that be taken as having halachic weight? So the Yerushalmi and Maseches Peah in the second parak famously says, "Ein lemeidin min ha'agadas." We do not learn halacha from agada. And this is a well-known idea, and presumably the simplest way to understand why this is, after all, it's all Torah, why would we not learn halacha from agada? The Nodeb Yehuda in the Tshuvas explains that the intent during an agada presentation is to inspire the Jewish people in areas of Musar and an outlook and development and idealism and all of these things, which are core to the emphasis there, is not on halachic accuracy. It's never meant with that in mind. And that's why you can't derive it from that. It's not correct. So says the Nodeb Yehuda. And that's why the Nodeb Yehuda himself is of the understanding that you can never learn halacha from agada. Others take a middle approach. If there's no contradiction to somewhere else in the halacha, it could be taken on board. Only if it conflicts, agada would have to back down. Those are the two primary positions. The Nodeb Yehuda never learns from agada. The Pri Chadash is famous for this qualified or equivocated stance of yes, unless it's contradicted by the halacha. Either way, why do we mention this here? There is a discussion in the commentary of the Rosh to Maseches Nedarim in the ninth perek. We're familiar with the idea that if a person has taken a shavua, he can get a hatara. That's kol nidrei b'shavuei, hataras nedarim, hataras shavuas. Now, sometimes a person, it's not his idea to take the shavua. Someone makes him take a shavua. Someone requires him to swear. So it's at the instigation of a second person. If a person takes a shavua at someone else's behest, so does that other person need to be there when you get the hatara, or no? Does it need to be with their approval and perhaps even presence? They're the one behind the shavua. They're the ones that made you take the shavua. Do they need to be part of your annulment or no? Says the Rosh, in my opinion, no. They don't need to be there. They are the inception of the Shavua is with them and because of them. But beyond that point, it's like every other Shavua, you can get a Hatara. They don't need to be there. They don't need to know about it. And why do I say this? And from where do I know this? Says the Rosh, from the Gemara's account about Yosef and Paro. Yosef said, my father made me take a Shavua that I would bury him in Canaan. And Paro said, well, you can go and get a Hatara. Now, in the end, Paro didn't want Yosef to get a Hatara, because if he gets a Hatara for one, he'll get for two, including Paro's Shavua. That may well be. But in principle, we see that it can be done. The Shavua was done at the instigation of Yaakov. Yaakov is not there. Yaakov is not alive anymore. But still, we see that in principle, says the Rosh, Yosef could have gotten an Ahatara, and that is why I say that the one who instigates the Shavua doesn't need to be there at the time of the annulment. Doesn't have to be there, doesn't have to know about it, doesn't have to agree to it. Now, as we can appreciate, there are a number of chidushim in what the Rosh just said. In drawing out this idea from Paro, there are numerous ideas that seem to have been taken on board. Firstly, all of this is before Matan Torah. We know that many things change. That itself is in a Yerushalmi elsewhere, in Maseches Moed Katan, in the third parak. We generally don't learn halachas from before Matan Torah. I think we certainly don't learn halachas from Paro. Paro is not a posek. And if he tells Yosef, go get a Hatara, well, that where is that coming from? He's conversant in Jewish law, and he's an authority to become a source for a psak. Maybe as far as Paro is concerned, a person can get an annulment. It could be that Yosef would have to go along with it. It's actually very interesting that Paro recognizes there can be such a thing as annulling a vow. That's generally taken to be a chiddush of the Torah itself. And maybe these two questions answer each other. Maybe as far as Paro is concerned, the ancient world that recognizes a Shavua doesn't recognize Hatara. But Paro says, but I know that the Jewish people do. Therefore, get one of your Hataras. Go to one of your Bezdins and get one of your Hataras. Which means he's more describing the situation as opposed to paskening, so to speak. But even so, many, many novel ideas here. But aside from everything else, which are important details, but details, there is an overarching question here. This is a halachic discussion. The exchange between Paro and Yosef is an agadic presentation. It's agada. What are we to do? And how is the Rosh saying that we can see from here? He's like reaching into this account of Yosef and Paro, Hatara, he's not there, but it's okay, and that's the halacha. It's agada. I thought we don't learn halacha from agada. The Rosh's response to this is quite striking. And it represents now a whole new position on this idea. And this whole idea of not learning halacha from agada. Says the Rosh, I know it's an agada. But in my vision, if this was not true halachically, the Gemara would not have mentioned it. It would not have been mentioned in the Shas if it doesn't check out halachically. This is a stunning statement of the Rosh. Because what the Rosh is saying is, when it comes to the issue of mixing and merging and transferring from the world of Agada to Halacha, it's not the subject that's all important. Is this a agadic discussion or a halachic discussion? It's the work that's important. Is this a halachic work? Is this an agadic work? Hamokum gorein. It all depends. As far as the Rosh is concerned, you know when we don't give halachic entry to agadas? From collections of agada, such as the Medrash. Medrash Agada, Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, and so on and so forth. It's an entire domain as a work. That's a midrashic work. Then we say, that's not for halacha. But But if you're in the Gemara, so nothing in the Gemara is there if it's not halachically sound, even agados. And this is something that the Rosh reiterates in other instances as well. And this is certainly not the unanimous view among Rishonim. There are other Rishonim who clearly put aside any Agada, even in the Gemara, but this is the fascinating position of the Rosh. And I mention it here because it all began in our Parsha, from the Gemara's account in the Agada of Paro's discussion with Yosef. And the Rosh says, I know it's an Agada, but it's in the Shas. So it has entry into the halachic discussion. What's very interesting to consider, even though we're not going to go into it, but just to fill out the picture, we can assume there will be a converse situation now. In other words, according to the Rosh, when we say we don't accept Agada, it means we don't accept from an Agadic work, but we do accept Agada in the Gemara, which is a halachic work. What would be the situation if you had a halachic discussion in an Agadic work? What would be the situation if you have a bona fide halachic give and take, but it's in the Medrash Rabbah or the Medrash Tanchuma? And it can happen. In fact, not only can it happen, the Medrash Tanchuma, its trademark opening for every parsha is to raise a halachic question. Every, as a rule, the Medrash Tanchuma on any parsha begins with the words Yelamdeinu Rabbeinu. Teach us, our master, what is the halacha in such and such a situation, and it will tie it in to something within the parsha. So much so that in many rabbinic circles, the Medrash Tanchuma wasn't referred to as the Medrash Tanchuma. It was called Medrash Yelamdeinu, because it always starts with the word Yelamdeinu. There is a tradition amongst Rabbanim, they will name the Medrash after the first word, Medrash Shocher Tov. Medrash Tehillim is called Shocher Tov, because that's the first pasuk it describes. And Medrash Shir HaShirim is called Medrash Tachik, and so on. So Medrash Tanchuma is called Medrash Yelamdeinu because it always starts with a halachic discussion. This is the converse of the Yosef and Paro case. Yosef and Paro is an agadic discussion in the Gemara. These Yelamdeinu Rabbeinus are halachic discussions in the Medrash. As surely as you embrace an agadic discussion in the Gemara, will you reject a halachic discussion in the Medrash? And if you do, what's the point of the discussion? But interestingly, the Maritz Chayesim, well, this will be our concluding comment with regards to this topic, even though it's obviously very, very broad and far-reaching, as we can appreciate. The Maritz Chayes, in one of his Sfarim entitled Darkei Hora'ah, actually says that according to this approach, yes, we would not give it admission or entry of a halachic discussion in the Medrash, for the very same logic. It's in the Medrash. And you may ask, but it looks and sounds like a halachic discussion. Says the Maritz Chayes, there's something about halachic discussions in the Medrash. What are they doing in the Medrash? These halachic discussions took the form of drushes that were given, of agadic drushes that were given and generally given to the masses. What's the best way to teach halacha to the masses? Give them a shir on Medrash and insert a halachic discussion there, and then they'll retain it. So the very nature of the halachic discussions in the Medrash are much more popular in form. And because that's true, that is why we might not be so quick to say, oh, let's draw halachic conclusions from there. There might be something about the one giving the drasha. He may, for example, have felt this is a halacha that will be mishandled. He doesn't want people to misunderstand and maybe take liberties. It could be to mishap. Perhaps he was more machmir than he needed to be, just to make sure. Because the greater exposure you give to a halachic message, the more chance there might be that people will misunderstand. And therefore, maybe he rounded edges just in order to keep things safe. Or conversely, maybe this was an exceptional situation and you felt that room for leniency unusually was required. Once we understand the context of these halachic discussions in the Medrash as being midrashic literal drushas to the unlearned and the unlettered, so that that's why amazingly we could understand the conclusion that we might not be so quick to bring them into the halakhic discourse itself. So these are very, very interesting questions, and all, as we say, triggered by Yosef and Pyro, as per our Parsha. Let us move forward a little bit, not too far actually, but also in the beginning of the Parsha, we have the event of the elevation of two of Yosef's sons, Menashe and Ephraim, to the status of Shvatim. Menashe and Ephraim, Kiruven v'Shimon Yehiuli. And there is room to ask, and we're so familiar with it, but Al Shumma, what is their Yaakov's grandsons? How are we to understand that they would become Shvatim, like his sons? That's a simple question, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be asked. The way Yaakov tells Yosef about this, and going back now to the beginning of the Parsha, in Perik Memches, Pasuk Hey. So the Pasuk reads, Yaakov talking to Yosef, Ve'ata, and now, Shnei banecha hanoladim necha be'eretz Mitzrayim, your two sons that were born to you in Mitzrayim, ad bo'i elecha, before I came to you in Mitzrayim, liheim, they are mine. Ephraim u'menashe, kiru'uven v'shimon yuli. Ephraim u'menashe would be like Shimon. So, it's very interesting that Yaakov introduces Menashe and Ephraim in this way, as the preamble, as the prelude to saying, I am going to turn them into Shvatim, or give them, bestow upon them, confer upon them the status of Shvatim, introduces them by saying, these are the sons that were born to you in Mitzrayim before I came. I mean, we know who Ephraim and Menashe are. I mean, Yosef knows who they are. Why is it important to describe them in this way? What does it add? But we see not only is this relevant, this description of them, it's actually makes all the difference. Because the next pasuk goes on to say, Umoladetecha, pasuk vav, and anyone else that you had, any other children you had, Asheholadeta achareihem, and we don't really know their names. But presumably there were, otherwise Yaakov wouldn't talk about them. Any other children after that? Lechayu, they're yours. Ashem achayem yikaru benachlasam, they'll be subsumed within the inheritance of the brothers. So in other words, this isn't an elevation of Yosef per se, as if to say, Yosef is the exception and his children will be Shvatim. It's not true. It's only true for the two sons that were born before Yaakov came. That is of the essence now. The Haraya, the proof being, the children that were born afterwards, this isn't true for them. But why is this all important, and why is it so influential? Reb Leib Mintzberg, in the Sefer Ben Melech, explains. It's so elegantly simple, but so profound. The explanation of Menashe and Ephraim, or more correctly, the introduction of Menashe and Ephraim as born before Yaakov came, that introduction is the explanation. That's why they will become Shvatim. But why? We know that we have three avos. The future of the Jewish people is built on three avos. Avram starts from scratch and begins a process, and Yitzchak continues the process. He gains from Avram, but continues. Yaakov continues further, and therefore that progression leads to the final product called the Avos, and everyone after that point are Shvatim. The building stage has finished with the progression of Avram to Yitzchak and then to Yaakov. The exception with reference to the future of the Jewish people is Yosef. And the reason why is because Yosef was separated from the rest of the brothers. He was separated from Yaakov and the rest of the family, as far as he knows, permanently, certainly until further notice. And it's amazing to consider now, Yosef is one of the sons. He doesn't know for sure if he will ever be reconnected with that family, with his family. And what does he do? He has his sons and he raises them in the tradition of the Avos, by himself. From a certain point of view, Yosef, without backing or support, is starting from the beginning. He is now independently raising a family. And what that means is, if you want to know why Menashe and Ephraim will come to be looked upon as Shvatim, it's because Yosef is looked upon as an Av. None of the other brothers are an Av in any way. They're not patriarchs in any way because they're all drawing from the threefold patriarchy of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. But Yosef can't draw from that. He's literally by himself. He's adrift, disconnected. It's all coming from him. In that regard, he's doing an Av's work. And the result is his sons become Shvatim. And that is why Yaakov describes Menashe and Ephraim as the sons that you bore and were raised, begat, and were raised before I came to Mitzrayim. Why is that so significant? Because once Yaakov comes to Mitzrayim, Yosef is reconnected with the family. He's now drawing on the roots and the past and the support and the legacy of Yaakov, just like all the other brothers. But these two sons were raised before any of that happened. Yosef by himself alone. And that's why those two brothers get consideration as Shvatim, because with regards to them, Yosef acted as an Av. And I think this gives us a deeper element within what Yosef says to the brothers, that whatever you did, you intended it to be for the bad, and in the end it worked out for the good, even better than it was before. Now Yosef says that with regards to, you sold me as a slave, and yet as per Hashem's plans, here I am as the ruler of Egypt. So it rebounded and skyrocketed. But a parallel development is happening. The brothers disconnected Yosef from being a son, and he ended up being a father. That's the circle here, which is an amazing thing. And I think this gives us deeper insight into, to go to back again to Perek Memches, just as a prelude to Yaakov actually bestowing the blessing on Yosef. It says, Pasuk Ches of Perek Memches, Vayar Yisrael es b'nei Yosef. So he's called Yisrael here because this has implications for the entire Jewish people. As the Malbim and others explain, the name Yisrael will be used in that context. This has national implications, the upgrading or the elevating of Menashe and Ephraim. So Yisrael sees b'nei Yosef, Vayomer mi eile, who are these? And we'll get back to that question. But Yosef says, Vayomer Yosef el Aviv, Banayhem, they're my sons. Asher nasan li Elokim bazeh, that Hashem gave me with this. And Unkelus translates the word with bazeh as Ke'an, in this place. And Yaakov says, okay, I'm going to bless them. What is being expressed there? What does Yaakov mean when he asks, who are they? He's assessing their essential worth, as Rashi and others explain. Are they worthy? What's their status? And Yosef says, their status is they're my sons. Hashem gave them to me here. And why does Yosef emphasize here? The point is because I was here away from home, without hope of ever coming back to home. And it was just me. And here they are. And they're just fine. And Yaakov says, Okay, they will be up. They will be elevated to Shvatim status. So, such a wonderful idea. Again, we're so familiar with it. Ephraim and Manasseh. Where does it come from? It comes from Yosef himself, and as we've mentioned in the past, based on Rafutner and others, Yosef, in some respects, is like an Av, not in every respect. Rafutner says it in his own unique way. The Avos, they're called the Avos, they're these formative personalities within the Jewish people, and that's why their entire lives are circumvented, more correctly circumscribed, contained within Chumash Bereishis. Chumash Bereishis is the Chumash HaYetzirah. It's the Chumash of creation. And they are the creation of the Jewish people. So the lives of the Avos are all contained within Chumash Bereishis. The Shvatim are already beyond that point, and therefore they're born in Bereishis, but their death is not recorded until Chumash Shemos. And what about Yosef? Where is Yosef's death recorded? Bereishis or Shemos? It's both. Chumash Bereishis ends with the recording the death of Yosef, and then it's reiterated in the beginning of Chumash Shemos. But why does he die twice? Why is his life encapsulated twice? Because it is contained on the one hand within Chumash Bereishis, but not entirely. In some respects, he's like an Av. In others, like a Ben. And thus we find that Manasseh and Ephraim sometimes are two of the 12 Shvatim, but sometimes they'll close. And it will become Yosef when Levi emerges is reckoned as one of the tribes. So then Ephraim and Manasseh, they close ranks and it becomes Shevet Yosef. And in many respects, we see that Yosef has aspects of an Av status, and Rav Mintzberg, in such a simple and straightforward way, explains to us why that is. He has a status of an Av because he did the actions and had the achievements of an Av. From here, I'd like to spend the final few moments discussing one of the brachas of Yaakov, and that is the bracha to Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi, they get the bracha together, even though not all of the aspects apply to them equally, but certainly, significantly, they're treated as one unit. And let us see in Perek Memtes, which is the Perek of the brachos. And then, Pasuk Hey, Shimon v'Levi achim. Shimon and Levi, they're brothers, they're always together, they're always in league with each other. And what does Yaakov say? Besodom al tovo nafshi. My soul will not come in their counsel. Bikal amatechat kavodi. And my honor will not be united with their assembly. Ki ba'apam hargu ish. Because in their fury, they killed a man, uvritzonam ikrushor. And through their will, or with their, they willfully ikrushor, they hamstrung an ox. What are these phrases referring to? So, generally speaking, the Ramban, who takes a very pshat approach here, not only are they all about the past, meaning about Shechem, but they're only about Shechem. For the Ramban, Yaakov does not reference the sale of Yosef or allude to it. In his brachos, Ramban famously is of the opinion that Yaakov didn't know about the sale of Yosef. Yosef didn't say it. The brothers for sure are not going to tell him. Rashi takes issue on that point. Rashi understands that there are references to the sale of Yosef. But according to the Ramban, this is all about Shechem. And I have no part in what they did. I disavow myself from what they did. They killed people and they destroyed property and so on. According to the Medrash, Besodam al tovo nafshi, let my soul not come in their council, and Bekalam atecha kavodi, let my honor not be united with their assembly, are references to future events. And one with regards to Shimon, one with regards to Levi. Let us take them one by one. Besodam al tovo nafshi, let my soul not come in their council, refers to the episode of Zimri. Zimri was the prince of Shimon. Nesibes Avla Shimoni. He was the prince of Shimon. That whole episode was Zimri and Cosby and so on. So that's the first phrase. It's about someone from Shimon. And what about Bikahala Matechad Kavodi? And what about not being connected to their assembly? Which assembly? An assembly that took that was instigated by someone from Levi, namely Korach. Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kos ben Levi. Vayikohalu al Moshe. They all assembled around Moshe. Says Yaakov, I want no part of that either. Not the actions of Zimri, not the actions of Korach. Why not? Well, for obvious reasons, because they're both incorrect. But Yaakov says more. The final two phrases, ki ba'apam hargu ish and birtsonam ikrushor, are understood by the Mefarshim as being respectively explanations as to why I don't want to be part of that or that. I don't want to be part of Zimri because of reason A, and I don't want to be part of Korach because of reason B. What is reason A? The third phrase of the Pasuk goes back to explain no part in Zimri. Ki ba'apam hargu ish. What does the actions of Shimon and Levi in Shechem have to do with Zimri? Says Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz, there's something about the actions of Shimon and Levi themselves, which is the undoing of the basis of what would later happen. It's not just that it's wrong. It's the opposite of what they did in Shechem. When it comes to Zimri, so he famously brings that Midianite princess, Cosby, to Moshe and says, can I marry her? If you say no, who lets you marry? Who let you marry the daughter of Yisro? What a thing to say. Now, seemingly the answer is very simple. The daughter of Yisro, Tzipora, converted. This is a Moabite girl. But it's deeper than that, because many Mefarshim explain that what Zimri is saying is to let her convert. The more the merrier. Yisro's daughter converted and you married her, so let her convert and I'll marry her. Now what's the answer? The answer is obviously this is a sham. It's a nothing. It's a vacuous enterprise for her to convert. Everyone knows that it's meaningless. But you might say, well, you know, on officially or on paper, she said yes. So who are you to judge? Says Yaakov, there's something very terrible about specifically someone from Shimon doing that. Why? Didn't the people of Shechem convert? Didn't they all do Mila with the view of uniting with the Jewish people? And what did you do? Did you embrace them? No, you wiped them out. But what about their Jewishness? It's nothing. It was never done for anything other than their own personal or national gains or regional gains. You understand that it's a meaningless thing. So having done that with that background, to then